I just want to get things right. 2 weeks ago, I was in Copenhagen doing the exact same presentation, but I think the website that collects information about the titles and the abstract was limited to 50 characters. And the title got cut off after SQL Server. So just to set things right, this is the title for the presentation. And I also want to set things right because you know, some of the people are expecting more of a deep dive. How many of you here are DBAs, database administrators, developers? Don't be shy. I used to be a developer. IT pros, sysadmins, project managers. Don't laugh. You might be one someday. Okay. Okay. More people are coming in. There's more seats up front. And my timer starts now. Okay. This is five things to consider when you plan on stretching. More people. A few seats up front. Coming over. More seats up here. Until everything is quiet. All right. So this is five things to consider when you want to stretch your failover clustered instances or availability groups to a disaster recovery site. Now, you could replace this disaster recovery site line here with anything, whether it's AWS, Azure, Rackspace, all of the cloud providers, because what I'm going to show you are principles and concepts that apply to just about anything when you want to stretch availability groups and failover clustered instances. Now, how many of you here have worked with failover clustered instances in the past? Okay, I don't see people smiling. Availability groups? Okay, let me start off with this quote that I've started telling people ever since 2012, when SQL Server 2012 availability groups were introduced. Your career as a SQL Server professional is dependent on the things that you're not even aware of. What does that mean? Well, that means your promotion, your next salary increase, your potential growth is now dependent on other people, not just you. Let me explain that. When I was growing up, one of the things that my parents taught me and my siblings was to have household chores assigned to us every single day. We're not supposed to do personal stuff. We can't play, we can't do anything else until we've finished our household chores. That also means that household chores are priority. Yes, on top of education. Every day, and my mom, here's the thing, my mom actually posted something like this in our bedrooms. Every day she actually checks what tasks were done every day. And at the end of the week, we either get a reward for completing all the tasks, and sometimes we get punishments if we don't complete the task. Now, how many of you here have had this when you were growing up? No? You're making me feel bad. Am I the only one with very bad childhood growing up? Okay, let me rephrase that. At one point, when my mom was looking at the list, she started looking at the items in there and asked me at one point, have you taken out the bottles, the glasses, recycles? And I'm like, what do you mean? Recycles? Growing up, I didn't actually know that I had to segregate the glass and the paper. Recycling was not a thing back then. That also tells you how old I am. It wasn't a thing, but now I'm supposed to be responsible for those. I don't know where she's going with that, but the thing is, it ended up as an additional task in my checklist. Okay. How many of you have seen this error message before? Or is somehow familiar with this error message and has seen it before? One, two, three. Okay. An exception occurred. Windows Server Failover Clustering Resource Control has returned error code 5057. The service may not be running. For more information, see error codes. Very intuitive. The attempt to create the network name and IP address for the listener failed. Sounds familiar? And the first time I saw this, I was kind of baffled. I was an operations engineer responsible for making sure that everything's highly available until somebody called me and told me about this. I told them, send me a screenshot of the error that you're getting and let me have a look at it. But here's the thing. When you get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning, of course, 3 o'clock in the morning is when all of us are asleep, unless you're a vampire. Is that you're so stressed out and you can't figure out what's wrong. And when this is the first time you've seen that error message, you kind of stressed out, right? And I'm quoting Earl Nightingale here. Whenever you're afraid, it's because you don't know enough. 2012, very first time that availability groups was released. That was the very first time I saw that error message. I want to replace the word afraid with stressed out. Again, 3 o'clock in the morning, you get a phone call. The system is down. The failover cluster is down. You don't know what to do, okay? My goal within the next 55 minutes is to give you a high-level overview of what to consider in case you want to deploy a failover clustered instance or a SQL Server availability group to a DR site, or again, replace DR with something like Microsoft Azure, AWS, or anything that's outside of your production data center. Now, let's start with concepts. I'm using a two-node SQL Server failover clustered instance as an example to illustrate the point because, well, why not? It's been there since SQL Server 7 in the good old days of Wolfpack. Anybody here know what Wolfpack is? Yes? No? It's not related to Wolverine, but it's Wolfpack would actually tell me how old you are if you know what that is, because it was the very first version of the Microsoft clustering services. So ever since SQL Server 7, Windows NT 4, this is how it has always been. Now, watch the animation. I made it a point to show you how the whole thing works. You have a SQL Server instance running on one, only one, whether you have 4 or 14 or 16 nodes in a cluster, it will only run on one node. Your client applications are actually connecting to the cluster, but the client application does not know that it's running on a cluster. As far as the application is concerned, it's just a SQL Server instance. SQL Server instance is running on this node. Of course, human nature or any potential problem might occur. That server goes down. Client applications get disconnected. The service gets moved from this server or this node to this node, or any of the available nodes. I don't know if you noticed, but client application got disconnected. Why? Well, it was offline. This is no different from you restarting your SQL Server instance. The only difference, of course, is when you restart your SQL Server instance, the only thing that's available to pick up the load is the server itself. In this case, if you have two, the other server, assuming it's online, will pick up the workload. It will be less than 30 seconds, assuming ideal conditions, to restart the SQL Server instance on that node. Clear? Are we all on the same page? People make it so complicated. That's how easy and simple it is. You can talk to any clustering experts, and they can make it so complicated that you don't even want to touch clustering. But that's how it is. In fact, I use a very simple analogy, the traffic light analogy. Stop, wait, and then start. That's all it is. Okay? Once it's back online, the client applications, depending on how it was written, can reconnect back to the SQL Server instance. Now, here's the thing. When SQL Server 2012 introduced availability groups, everyone thought it was complicated. Not really. If you understand how Windows Server failover clustering works, availability group simply sits on top of the failover clustering infrastructure. That's all it is. Okay? Now, and notice that I actually removed the shared storage underneath because availability groups don't need shared storage. But here's the truth about this. What a lot of clustering experts don't tell you is the fact when you look at this architecture, there are five things that you won't hear people talk about commonly. What are those five things? Let's see the animation one more time. And I've introduced Active Directory and DNS. In fact, those are the two things of the five things that you need to consider. When that failover happens, we instantly think about the cluster moving the workload, in this case, the SQL Server failover cluster instance or the availability group in different nodes without thinking about the external dependencies of that thing. I highlighted Active Directory and DNS. In fact, whether you like it or not, ever since Wolfpack or NT 4.0, clustering has always depended on Active Directory. Always. In fact, you can't even provision a failover clustered instance or an availability groups up until 2016 without Active Directory. Remember what I mentioned in my first slide? Your career is now dependent on the things. Now, how many of you here manage Active Directory in DNS? 1, 2, 3. So you know what I'm talking about. For the rest of us, our careers are now dependent on the Active Directory and the DNS guys. Two things. Number three is the communication between all of the nodes in the cluster. In this case, between these two. So we talked about Active Directory. We talked about DNS. We talked about the heartbeat communication. And then the quorum, the fourth thing. The fifth one is the application configuration. I'm done. Thank you. That's all for today. But we don't talk about this. We don't. We really don't talk about this. Oh, we do actually talk about this. When somebody starts calling you in the middle of the night and telling you, look, the cluster is down, and we better start talking about it. Okay? Which is why I decided to talk about those five things. Now, didn't I mention you can replace DR with anything, whether it's Azure or AWS, because the concepts and the principles are the same, right? The first one is Active Directory. And I can talk about this from experience because back in 2006, when I was still a data center engineer, I learned this the hard way. We were managing a cluster for a Citrix farm. And the Citrix farm is actually using a 4-node SQL Server failover clustered instance. Patch Tuesdays happen. What do you do on Patch Tuesdays? You install the patches. Well, we don't do it on Tuesdays. We do it on the weekend. And we follow a proper change management process. We patch the servers on Saturday. And, of course, I start off patching the inactive node or the standby. And then once that's ready, we install the patch on the active node and then failover. And expect everything to work. Right? Accidentally, I want to say accidental because sometimes, you know, things just happen, right? One of the operations engineers was smart enough to reboot all of the domain controllers. She gets it. I decide to fail over after the patching process, decides to fail over MySQL Server fail, and it doesn't work. It really doesn't work. Why? Because whether you like it or not, that failover clustered instance, or in the case of an availability group, the listener name, is actually an Active Directory computer object. How many of you here are actually managing Active Directory? 1, 2, 3. How many of you here don't manage Active Directory? Oh, so the availability of your failover clustered instance and your availability groups are now dependent on the Active Directory guys. Remember that error message that I showed you earlier? That was a very common error message in the early days of availability groups because, well, as a DBA, I don't have permissions to create objects in Active Directory. Now, let's go back to the availability part. When I fail over, and because it's an Active Directory object, no different from computer objects and user objects, what do you do when you have to log into Active Directory? What do you do? So you need to log into Active Directory. What do you do? Control-Alt-Delete, and then you provide your credentials. On the assumption that, of course, your account actually exists. If your account does not exist, then you can't log in. Imagine if that SQL Server failover clustered instance, again, it's a computer object in Active Directory. Imagine if during the failover, it asks Active Directory and checks whether or not the object exists. What happens if the object does not exist?
Error message.
What else? It won't start. Because, again, just like user objects, they need to be authenticated. If it can't authenticate, then it won't be brought online. And some people are nodding because they know exactly what this means. Now, we didn't really think about this back in the days because all we care about is this. In a production environment where all your domain controllers are seated next to each other, every single object pertaining to availability groups and failover clustered instances are replicated as quick as less than 30 seconds. Okay? The reality is, when you're now stretching your failover clustered instances and availability groups to a DR site, there is actually a default behavior that the smart Active Directory guys know about that we SQL Server folks don't. By default, inter-site replication across each link occurs every 3 hours. I don't understand that. It means if you decide to fail over your availability groups or your failover clustered instance from production to DR, if that object does not exist because it's less than 3 hours before the object gets replicated, then there's no way for you to bring it online.
You can manually force it
on the assumption that you're in good terms with your Active Directory guys. When was the last time you brought your Active Directory guys and bought them beer? Okay. Why? Because, again, by default, in a security-conscious environment, your domain account should not be allowed to create Active Directory objects. Okay. Well, you can force your Active Directory guys to say, hey, we can change this from 3 hours to 15 minutes. Not bad, right? 15 minutes is manageable, but I see you shaking your head. But here's the thing. Is 15 minutes good enough for your recovery objective? See, I see heads nodding. And I always tell people this. When you're visiting Amazon's website and the website is not responding, you don't say, oh, the network's down, or the database is down. No, you say it's down, period. Okay? You can tell your Active Directory guys to force the replication to happen every 15 minutes between production and DR so that by the time you decide to fail over to DR, you know that your failover clustered instance name or your availability group listener name is already in the DR site. Okay? But again, you have to be in good terms with your Active Directory guys. I've actually written a blog post about this on the impacts of Active Directory without the drama of, you know, somebody rebooting all of the domain controllers. But the point is the availability of your failover clustered instances and your availability groups are still dependent on Active Directory as of SQL Server 2016, okay? Unless you decide to implement what's known as Active Directory Detached Cluster, where you can create a failover cluster with no Active Directory object. Anybody working with Windows Server 2016? One, two, anybody try the domainless clusters? Which means you don't have to worry about the Active Directory, guys. Whether that's a good thing or not is totally up to you. The second one is DNS. Now, here's the thing. Whether you're working with SQL Server 2016 running on top of Windows Server 2016 or older versions, you still need DNS. Now, you might be wondering, why do I have to worry about that? Well, again, your client applications don't know anything about the cluster. All they know is that if I request the DNS server for a name, it'll give me an IP, right? Name, IP combination, and that's all it needs to know. But the thing is, if you don't have a DNS server, how do you connect to the database? Hosts file? So imagine a point-of-sale application with 2,500 terminals. You sure you want to manually type host file for 2,500 client? I don't. Which is why DNS is very important. Now, by default, if your clusters depend so much on Active Directory, there is this concept of Active Directory integrated DNS zones, which means the DNS will only update its DNS database if Active Directory tells it so. Why? For security purposes. Right? You don't want anybody to be registering on the DNS servers. Now, Remember when we said that the failover clustered instance name or the listener name gets created, it also creates an Active Directory object. The Active Directory object gets created as a DNS object with its corresponding IP address. Okay? Now, in a production setting where your nodes are only in a single data center, you don't really have to worry about that. Why? Well, again, much like having domain controllers sitting beside each other, your DNS servers are also sitting beside each other, so you don't have to worry about replication and stuff like that. Okay? This is a property that was introduced in Windows Server 2008, not a SQL Server property, but a failover cluster property. Register all providers' IP. It tells the DNS, or rather the cluster, this is again a cluster property, it tells the DNS, look, because I have a production network and a DR network, I've got two virtual IP addresses. I want you to register both. Okay, why? Well, it's just like saying if I am connecting to the instance that is currently hosted in my production data center, I need to know what IP address that is. If I'm connecting to my DR data center and the instance is in my DR data center, I need to know what IP address that is. How many of you here manage your network like a network administrator, where you're assigning IP addresses, assigning subnets? Wait a second, this is not a SQL Server task. This is a DNS administrator task. Why am I supposed to be concerned about that? Didn't I mention earlier when Amazon's website is down, you don't say that the database is down? You say, it's down, period. Right? So if your applications can connect because it could not resolve the IP address because, well, it's now on the DR site, well, technically, it's offline. It doesn't matter how good of a database administrator you are. If the application could not connect to the database, even though it's online, it's technically offline. This will register all of the available IP addresses for a single listener name or a single virtual network name for the SQL Server failover clustered instance. Now, the default value is 20 minutes. What do I mean by that? Every 20 minutes, a client DNS client application will ask the DNS server, hey, can you give me a new IP address? If nothing has changed, well and good. But here's the thing. In a production setting, you fail over between production one node and the other, the IP address won't change. Why? Because it's in the same network subnet, right? So we barely even considered this in the past. You fail over to DR, well, because your production IP addresses are now different from your DR IP addresses, you now have a completely different IP address. So when the client application asks for that IP address and it could not reach that IP address, technically, it's offline. 20 minutes, every 20 minutes. Okay? Now, you can change this if you want by changing the host record TTL value. Again, another cluster property, not a SQL Server property, that tells the DNS server, look, this is how frequent that you need to tell the clients to ask for newer IP addresses. Of course, in reality, you will only have two, production and DR IP addresses. So you only need to do this once. But, like I said, you need to talk to your DNS administrators whether or not you can change this. Why? Imagine if you have five application servers, asking the DNS server, look, give me a new IP address. If those are only five every 20 minutes, that's fine. If you have a point of sale system where you have 2,500 clients asking the DNS server every 20 minutes, then you might end up with a denial of service attack on your DNS servers just because you're lowering this particular value. And again, I've written something about this on my blog, but the point is your applications can only connect to failover clustered instances or your availability group's listener name if they can find it on the network. That's the job of the DNS server. Okay? We haven't even talked about SQL Server yet. We haven't. And we're not going to be talking about SQL Server. 2 weeks ago when I did the same presentation, somebody actually made a comment or feedback about the presentation saying, I expect to learn something about SQL Server in this presentation, and I didn't learn anything about SQL Server. Haha. The reality is SQL Server is just dependent on these things. Whether you like it or not, remember how I started off the presentation? Your career is now dependent on the things that have nothing to do with SQL Server. Okay? So Active Directory, authentication, DNS, how to locate the listener name and the failover clustered instance name. The third one is the heartbeat. Again, not a SQL Server property, but a cluster property. Now, what is this heartbeat? What is the whole concept behind the heartbeat? I kind of use the illustration where, you know, you and your friend will watch a football game. I need to use the word football instead of soccer. Football game, and you're both coming from work and say, we want to meet at this place at this time. I'm going to send you a text message. Send me back so that we know exactly where to go, where we want to sit, what time are we going to be there. Imagine your friend sending you a text message saying, look, I'm already here. I'm fine. Where are you? You respond back and say, hey, I'm on my way to work. I'm good. I'm fine, but I'll see you in 5 minutes. Sounds good? Imagine that conversation happening every 5 seconds. What for? Well, just because you two are so close together, you don't want to be separated and you're hanging out. 5 seconds is a default time where the cluster needs to know if this node is fine or this node is fine. Why? Well, you certainly don't want to be running SQL Server on this node if it's not fine. Again, whether it's availability groups or a failover clustered instance. You certainly don't want to be running SQL Server on this node if it's offline. Heartbeat is simply the cluster asking, well, not the cluster, but the members of the cluster asking everyone, are you fine? Are you okay? Are you healthy? Can I talk to you? Every 5 seconds. Okay. Why is this important? Like I said, if the cluster can't even talk to this, there's no way that the cluster can move the workload to this node unless it's healthy. That's the whole point of high availability. Okay? Now, here's the thing. We have not paid attention to this in the past because, again, when the nodes of the cluster are seated next to each other, they're close enough that a message would only take a fraction of a millisecond to get to the other node, we don't care. Right? Have you ever sent a text message to a friend of yours who's in the other side of the world? How long did it take for your friend to get the text message? Much longer than when you're actually sitting next to each other, depending on what your service provider is. But the point is the long...
Not so much.
But the point is when you're sending a message that far, it will take a long time to get a response. Okay, like I said, we barely paid attention to this because in a single data center setup, the nodes of the cluster are seated next to each other, maybe on the same rack, maybe on the same chassis, right? Or maybe on different racks, but they're still in the same data center, where the network latency is not as bad as when you're thinking about stretch clusters, which is why this is only applicable in multi-subnet or geographically dispersed clusters. Now, again, another property of the cluster, same subnet delay, which this is the frequency of heartbeats, I mean the amount of messages sent on the nodes in the same network subnet. Like I said, we barely pay attention to this because if the servers are sitting next to each other, the network latency is almost negligible. Default value is 1 second. 1 second maximum value is 2 seconds. Okay? There is another property called same subnet threshold. Okay? This is the missed heartbeats. Remember that message being sent, text message being sent? If my friend did not respond within 5 text messages that I sent, I could probably call 999. Yes. Of course, I don't want to assume that about my friend, whether he is still alive. He might look alive, but he's... never mind. Default value is 5 and a maximum is 120 seconds. What does this mean? If you're looking at a single data center deployment, in a production setting, your possible threshold before potential downtime is 5 seconds. I'll send you a text message every second for 5 seconds. If I don't get a response within 5 seconds, if you missed 5 heartbeats, then I'm going to assume that you're offline, you're unhealthy, you're unavailable. Does that impact SQL Server? Not really. unless you restart the node that's currently running your SQL Server workload. Because if that's the case, the cluster would be forced to move that workload onto that node if it's a two-node cluster. And if that node's offline, then technically your cluster is offline. Okay? Again, something that we haven't paid attention to in the past is cross-subnet delay. From the name itself, is the delay between heartbeat sent on different network subnets. Okay? Now, in the good old days of Windows Server 2008, where SQL Server 2008 does not support multi-subnet deployments, your network administrators actually cursed you for asking for a stretched VLAN because you're making their lives difficult. Okay? Windows Server 2008 introduced support for multiple network subnets. SQL Server 2012 introduced the concept of having multiple network subnets. That's why this property has been introduced. Again, not a SQL Server property, but a Windows failover cluster property. Default value is, wow, 1 second. If you have servers in the United States and you send a ping test between your servers in Poland and servers in the US, do you expect a response as quick as when your servers are actually within the same network? No, it's slower, right? But the default value is still 1 second. Maximum value of 4 seconds, okay? Same property, different name, cross subnet, which means it's the threshold when you're dealing with nodes in a different network subnet. Default value, 5 seconds, or rather 5 missed heartbeats, maximum of 120, which means if you do the math, if you're looking at a stretched cluster where you have nodes in production data center and nodes in a DR data center, the potential downtime is still the same as when the nodes are in the same data center. But that does not make any sense. Because, again, when you look at network latency between production and DR, which is probably on the other side of the world, it would take longer. Does that make sense? Questions at this point? And let me emphasize, we haven't even talked about SQL Server yet. Okay? So we'll take the default for all of the nodes in the same data center, whether it's in here or in there. And let's say I want to modify this to, instead of using the default, we'll use a cross-subnet threshold of 7 and use a cross-subnet delay value of 3 seconds, in milliseconds the value is, instead of 1 second. Which means I have 21 seconds before I can declare the nodes on the other data center to be offline. Well, what if my network service provider is offline for 4 hours? Oh, that never happens. They're always online. They're always available. Your career is now dependent on your network service provider because you need to know what their service level agreement is. Otherwise, the entire cluster would go offline based on the next item that I'm going to talk about. But before I do that, this was introduced in Windows Server 2016, the concept of site awareness. In the past, Windows Server 2008, Windows Server 2012, or 2012 R2, you have to rely on your magic to make things work. What does that mean? Well, the cluster does not really have an idea that your servers are in production or in DR. It doesn't. Okay? Even if you tell it to, it won't recognize that. Okay? The only thing that would determine whether your servers are in production and DR is basically the IP address assignments on the nodes. That's it. Okay? Which means you really have to rely on your network guys to pick the appropriate network subnets, the right IP addresses for all of the nodes, to make sure that, you know, there's a segregation between production IP and DR IP, okay? Which also means that you do not have any control at all on how the cluster behaves if in case you're indeed your network service provider is offline for 4 hours, which never happens, okay? The point is now with Windows Server 2016 failover cluster, you can tell the cluster, look, I can define that as my production. I can define this as my DR, not just from a physical definition, because again, they're physically in production and DR data centers. Now, you're logically telling the cluster, any server in this is logically in my production data center. Any node in this is logically in my DR data center, which means you're basically telling the cluster, look, whatever happens in there, forget about it, because that's not my priority. Unless, of course, you're dealing with an availability group or a failover cluster instance where you have active workloads running in here and active workloads running in here, because that's what most CIOs want. You know, well, that server's not doing anything. Let's run some workloads on it, right? But here you're technically telling the cluster, logically, this is how everything should be arranged. In the past, you used the property of the cluster called lower quorum priority node ID, kind of a tongue twister. But the point is, this is the only way that you tell the cluster, look, any node in that DR should have a lower priority in terms of voting towards the quorum, which I will talk about next. Okay? In Windows Server 2016, you don't have to do that. Okay? You just tell the cluster, look, again, any node in this section is logically in my production, and anything in that section is logically in my DR data center. Okay? And you could specify that this is now my primary site, which means the cluster will pay more attention to this and will prioritize activities within the cluster in terms of this particular data center, okay? Which introduces two new properties called the cross-site delay, because back in the previous versions, we're only talking about cross-subnet delay, right? Nobody's stopping you from creating nodes or adding nodes in the same data center but on different subnets. Okay? Now you could logically define the sites and you could configure these properties. Default value is 1, maximum of 4. Again, same concept, but now we're not just concerned about different network subdivisions between your cluster nodes. You're now concerned about sites. That makes sense? With that comes the cross-site threshold. Same concept, but now we're talking about sites, not network subnets, but sites, which is a default of 20 with a maximum of 120. Okay? These properties will determine, and again, I wrote a blog post about this. These properties, the same subnet delay, same subnet threshold, cross-subnet delay, cross-subnet threshold, cross-site delay and cross-site threshold. Kind of hard to memorize all that. There's a reason I'm in IT. I hate memorizing stuff. Okay, but when people keep asking questions about it, you kind of they kind of become second nature. And so those properties, and the reason why I highlighted those properties, influence the number four thing that we need to be concerned about. So we talked about Active Directory, it was the first one. The second one is DNS. Third is Heartbeat. The fourth is Quorum. Okay, now here's the thing. I cannot do justice with talking about the cluster in less than 5 minutes. Because, as far as I'm concerned, it's the most complex, most convoluted, most confusing topic, yet the most important aspect of why your failover cluster is up and running. See, just by saying that, everybody gets confused. <laughs> 2013 was the time when I was called in to deploy a SharePoint farm for a customer. SharePoint 2013 was out, and SQL Server 2012 availability groups were the de facto database structure for SharePoint. A bit of a side note, the SharePoint team actually financed part of the development for availability groups. Now you get it. But the point is, in fact, back in those days, you will see more documentation about availability groups from the SharePoint product team. Side note. But the fact is, they didn't get me involved in the SharePoint aspect. They only got me involved in the database. Two-node Windows Server failover cluster to replica availability group with a file share witness. Well and good, right? I told them, I noticed there was an error message in the failover cluster where the file share keeps going offline on a regular basis. And I told them, look, there's something wrong with your file share. This is production. Take care of it. Like, yeah, well, it's a highly available file share. It's on a cluster. No need to worry about it. Okay, I want it in writing. Send an email. And I, yes, email is a legal document that gets you protected. So I sent an email. Patch Tuesday. I don't know what's it would patch Tuesdays. They installed a patch on the standby replica, the secondary replica. What do you do after installing a patch? You restart, you reboot, right? While the file share is still offline, rebooted the secondary replica. Boom. SharePoint databases are offline. Called me up and said, what's wrong? I said, it's by design. They didn't like it when I said that. Quorum, like I said, is the most complex, most confusing, most convoluted concept within a failover cluster, but it's the most important one. To a point, I decided to create an entire course just on the topic of quorum, because that's how important it is. Now, what is quorum, by the way? What is it for? Why are we even concerned about this? Think about quorum, and the way I look at quorum is like, in a democracy where the majority of the votes would win. It doesn't matter if you have 100 people and you only get 51 votes, it's still a majority. Anything that's above 50%, whether it's 50.1, is still a majority, right? In a failover cluster context, okay, the only way to get a majority of votes is to get an odd number of votes. Okay, that is the goal. Okay, by default, all of the nodes will have a vote, all of them. Okay, whether you're running an availability group or SQL Server or not, what do you mean? Well, you can have a third node and not run SQL Server on top of it. It will still get a vote, right? Yes. Your career is now dependent on that node. That has nothing to do with SQL Server. Now. When availability groups was introduced in 2012, the concept of file share as a witness has been introduced. Well, it's really nothing new because Windows Server 2008 introduced the concept of using a file share witness. Now, why file share witness? And this is something that I argue with a lot of the clustering experts out there about. A file share is cheap. You can make it highly available without the cost of very expensive software to do block-level replication for shared storage. Why shared storage? Well, again, Wolfpack days when NT4 only knew shared storage as an additional vote. This is cheap, right? And there will always be arguments against it because of the cluster database and, you know, changes in the cluster will have to be stored in the cluster database. But again, at the end of the day, I'm more concerned with, number one, making sure that it solves a problem and it does not cost a lot. I'd rather get the savings as my additional consulting fee, if that's fine with a customer. Now, what happens if you lose quorum? Well, telling the story of that SharePoint database that went offline, you get blamed when you lose the quorum. Okay, it does. Here's what I think about it. I don't care what Microsoft says. If you lose the quorum, you get blamed. Funny, not funny, but the truth is, if you lose the quorum, you get blamed. Okay? And I need to hammer that into a lot of people because they don't pay attention to this. Now, it really depends on the version of Windows Server operating system that you're running on. Anybody still running Windows Server 2008? 1, 2, 3. Windows Server 2008 clusters? Too bad. Yes, somebody said we know. The risk there is Windows Server 2008 does not have the concept of dynamic quorum and dynamic witness. Well, what do you mean dynamic quorum, dynamic witness? Remember that all the quorum is to achieve majority of votes. If you don't have majority of votes, the quorum goes offline, whether you like it or not. In that particular case, the SharePoint databases, the instance is okay. Well, what do you mean it's okay? Well, I can connect to the master database. I can query the MSDB database. Everything's fine. Unfortunately, the databases inside the availability groups are not available because it's running on top of the cluster. And so that's the impact that you get when the quorum becomes unavailable. When it goes below majority of votes, you get blamed, whether you like it or not. So let's take a look at that. The most common question that I get is, so where do I put the file share witness? Anybody? If you decide to use a file share witness as that additional vote, because I can't just rely on four nodes. Odd numbers is what I need, right? What's half of four? Two. Two is not a majority. So I'll use a file share witness. Where do you want to put your file share witness?
Not inside a virtual machine, mm-hmm. a separate machine, but as a separate file share on an FS share on a storage array.
FS share on a storage array. Anybody else?
Scanning out by server.
Hmm?
Scanning out by server.
SOF. Okay.
Azure.
Has anybody heard Microsoft and Amazon telling you put it on a third data center? Why do you think they say that? Because they're in the business of running data centers. They want your money. Of course, it makes sense for them to make that recommendation. As far as, like I said, as far as I'm concerned, if it solves a problem and it does not cost a lot. What I do is, of course, I would not spin up another data center just for that file share. But that's what Microsoft and Amazon and Google want you to do, right? Does it make sense? So what I'll do is I'll put that in the same data center as what I'm trying to protect. A lot of clustering experts would disagree with me on this. But, if that cluster is offline, you got worse problems that you could ever imagine. Okay, I'm not going to be worried about that file share if my entire data center is offline. Okay, which is why I would rather have that file share in the same data center as what I'm trying to protect. Okay, now you can provision another file share in the DR. You don't add it to the cluster as a witness. Although Microsoft terms it as an asymmetric witness. What do I mean by that? Well, here's the thing. If this entire data center goes down, how many votes do we actually need? We got 5. How many do we need in order to get the cluster up and running?
3.
I lost 1, 2, 3. What happens to that node or that part of the cluster? Nothing. It remains offline. You have to force the cluster to go online, but you still have an even number of votes in there because you only have 2 nodes. I need to get another vote available in order to function the way I want to after a real disaster. In fact, one of my customers back in 2008, we provisioned a stretched cluster. 2 nodes in here, SQL Server failover cluster instance, and in here, and of course, we don't have availability groups back then. We had a single node SQL Server failover cluster instance for DR. Single node. Why? Well, it's still a cluster, right? Licensing-wise, I only have to worry about 1 node, right? Why would I want to spend more money on DR? I only need the bare minimum, okay? In a real disaster, part of the disaster recovery process is let's spin up a new instance or new VM, add it to the cluster, and that's fine, okay? Technology should not answer every single problem because if it does, we don't need to be here. Okay, we have a role to play in order to solve other problems in the future. Now, I mentioned that this was introduced, the concept of dynamic quorum and dynamic witness was introduced. Well, dynamic quorum was introduced in 2012. Dynamic witness was introduced in 2012 R2, which is why I mentioned the behavior of your cluster quorum depends so much on the version of Windows Server operating system that you're running. Which also means if you're still running Windows Server 2008, I feel so sorry for you. Okay, and I always tell my customers this. I don't get commissions for selling Microsoft licenses, right? If I do, I'll always tell my customers to go Enterprise Edition. I don't get commissions. I don't get any from Microsoft. But why do I recommend running Windows Server 2012 R2? Because the cost of upgrading will eventually be cheaper than overall operations when you get called in because the cluster went down, you have to fix it, okay? So this concept was introduced in Windows Server 2016, the quorum that is site aware. What does that mean? Remember what I mentioned about your network service providers being always available? Now, imagine this. If this, let's say if this connection goes offline, remember how all of the nodes will have a vote towards the core? Let's say that network connection goes offline. There's a possibility that this section over here would think, oh, we got majority. There's a possibility, if you don't have a witness. Okay? Which means there's also a possibility that the workload might end up being there. Again, I'm just saying there's a possibility. Okay? If that network connection goes offline, you can tell the cluster, look, whatever happens, let this be a much lower priority. That's one of the reasons why we've decided to configure the production site as our preferred site. Which means at that point, when this network connectivity goes down, the cluster will then tell every single member, look, ignore anything that's happening in this, because it doesn't really matter whether these two are online. They can't talk to those two. Right? Which means heartbeat would be affected. And if heartbeat is affected, quorum gets affected. If quorum gets affected, availability gets affected. If availability gets affected, you get blamed. That's really how it works. Okay? So by telling the cluster, look, this is, again, Windows Server 2016 and higher. If I tell the cluster, look, this is my production site and this is my preferred site, if this thing goes offline, the cluster will then ignore anything coming from here. Too bad if you have workload coming from this. Okay, but that is a business decision, not a technical decision. Okay? We're now down to number four, but we haven't talked about SQL Server yet. And I keep highlighting that. Okay? Again, only in Windows Server 2016, when you have something like this, the quorum is now site-aware, where if this thing goes offline, those two will not have additional votes. Now, if, say, you've called your network service provider every 5 minutes, open up a ticket, maybe 25 tickets, just to force them to address that network issue. They bring it back online. The cluster will automatically add the nodes back, which means the nodes will have votes toward the quorum. Okay? So think of it this way. If this is not available, it's as if you only have a three or two node cluster with an extra vote. Okay? Whereas in this case, I've got a four-node cluster with an extra vote. Questions so far? Didn't I say this is the most convoluted, most confusing, and most complex topic ever, which is the most important one as far as I'm concerned? Okay, and I talked about this again in one of the blog posts that I've written, but again, 5-10 minutes is not enough to do justice to the topic, because you still have to understand how dynamic quorum works and how dynamic witness works and how you combine your workloads and how you design to make sure that you're not spending a lot of money and at the same time making sure that you're meeting your recovery objectives. Number five, didn't I say five? Yes, five, is how that application behaves. Okay, when Windows Server, SQL Server 2012 was released and availability groups was introduced, because SQL Server runs on top of the .NET framework, you were also asked if you want to failover that application to DR automatically. I don't really believe in automatic failovers to DR. Because your databases do not live in isolation. Okay? So I really have to be concerned about if this thing fails over, I have to coordinate my entire team, not just the database team, the network team, the systems team, the applications team, because the last thing you want is for your databases to be sitting here and your applications to be sitting here. That's the worst situation you could be in. Okay. Now, remember what we talked about in number two about DNS? Initially, your client applications don't know anything about SQL Server or where it lives. It first asks the DNS server, hey, what's the IP address of this instance or this listener name? DNS responds, gives that response back, and then the application uses that to connect to the SQL Server instance or the listener name. If this thing goes offline, of course, the application can't talk to this DNS server. It has to talk to that DNS server. Same process. SQL Server is, of course, this is something that you as the database administrator has to do, you have to move the workload from production to DR on the assumption that everything else also works. Okay? You move that over there, and then the application does the exact same thing. Hey, DNS, tell me the IP address. Assuming, of course, the IP address is already there based on the register all providers IP property. DNS tells the application, look, this is the new IP address. You go ahead and connect to it. Okay? The thing is, that also depends on whether or not your applications support that connection property or that connection attribute. And you have to have .NET Framework 4.5 or higher in order to support that. Okay? Which means if you're running legacy applications, there's no way for you to really take advantage of this. Okay? Which is why I'm not really a big fan of automatic failover for DR. Why? Because in reality, there's still legacy code that we can't get rid of. That's reality. Microsoft is living in the clouds where it doesn't rain. Okay? We live in the real world. And so this is what I tell my customers. The reality is I'm more in favor of defining processes because the processes will determine whether or not I can automate some of those tasks. I actually have a client application that I've written back in 2011, which uses the .NET Framework 4.5, and it's basically a simple application that, you know, you can type your own connection string, where you can have that multi-subnet failover equal to true attribute as part of your connection string. Now, I started off by saying your career is now dependent on the things that you're not even aware of, and it's also important for you to know how to talk to your Active Directory guys, your DNS guys, your network guys, and your application developers. We still haven't talked about SQL Server. We still have not talked about SQL Server because the reality is the availability of your databases are no longer dependent on just SQL Server. It will depend on your Active Directory guys, on your DNS guys, on your network guys, and your application developers. Okay? Because when you define the recovery time objective for your applications, you're not just looking at the database. Again, it doesn't matter how good of a database administrator you are. I don't care if you can fail over or recover a database in less than 5 minutes. If the application can't connect to it, it's technically offline. That's why you need to really think about the entire infrastructure. And I want to end with this, because the truth is your career is really dependent on those guys, which means you need to be able to talk to them properly. You need to be able to build really good relationships with them, because sooner or later, the issue might come from these components, not necessarily SQL Server, but because you're a DBA, you're the default blame acceptor. Questions? By the way, this is the URL where you can access the five things. It's a blog post. It's a long a series of blog posts. I'm also going to upload the slide deck, but you can take a picture of this if you want, or I can post a selfie. Questions so far? And that's my alarm. Yes, I'm 1 minute early. Questions? You guys are... yes, question.
Yeah, so you're saying in the multi-subnet failover, you have the same DNS name. Mm-hmm. Clients are connected to the same DNS name.
Yes.
But different IP.
Yes.
So
now they are getting two IPs.
Yes, but the same DNS name.
How can you register a service principal name in Kerberos? Mm-hmm. Can you do that?
Great question. So the question was, if you have an IP address for production and an IP address for DR, and you want to register a service principal name, how do you do that with DNS? You actually don't. Because SPN is all about Active Directory. The IP is all about the DNS. They're totally separate. Okay. But in an Active Directory integrated DNS zone, it's Active Directory responsible for telling the DNS, look, you need to register the IP address. Okay? If you don't have that, you get the error message that I showed you earlier. Because Active Directory is telling DNS, look, you need to register this, but you can't register. That's why the listener creation is failing. In fact, I've got friends from CSS, the Microsoft customer support service teams. And in fact, they'll tell you, well, they told me, top two things. Top two issues that customers call them for is Active Directory and DNS. not SQL Server, Active Directory, and DNS. My email, my contact information, any other questions that you have for me?
Can we use this script as for a quorum instead of FileShare?
Great question. So the question was, can we use a disk witness versus a file share for a stretch cluster rehab production in DR? The way I answer that question is, how much zeros do you want to add to that check that you want to pay your shared storage vendor?
Okay.
Yes. And I certainly don't want to answer that question because it's the CFOs usually or the CIOs who make that decision. I just lead them into it without actually telling them. Okay, but some of the cluster experts would disagree with me on that. At the end of the day, the guy that has the checkbook makes the decision. So you better be nice to them. Questions? Other questions? But yeah, it's more complicated than that, by the way. But we can talk about it, but it really is more complicated than that. Yes?
Can we get rid of the error messages in the cluster that says that we cannot register our records in DNS?
Great question. Can you actually eliminate or get rid of the error message that has nothing to do with the cluster but has everything to do with the DNS? Here's my take on it. I don't want your environment to end up in the same way that my previous customer did, and they started blaming me. Because an error message said something. I know, I used to be an operations guy where I usually look at my email notification, click Control A, hit Shift, and delete everything without even reading them, right? And the point that I'm trying to make here is that an error might look benign, but I'm not looking at error message, I'm looking at patterns, okay? Pattern recognition is something that you could develop. It's a skill that you can develop, okay? I don't want you to respond to email alerts. I want you to develop the skill of pattern recognition so that you can easily identify what the potential error is even before it happens. It's called being proactive. Okay, so I won't recommend that you ignore those or even eliminate those messages, but you can.
No, but once there's a failover, a cluster tries to register the name.
Yes.
So it's retrying this in a, I don't know, endless. So I just go to the cluster and see those all the error messages, and I would like to get a clear situation that. That my cluster is okay.
Right.
So is there a way to, configure somehow the cluster that is ignoring this message, sending this or not trying this?
Like I said, the cluster will always register that because it's dependent on the DNS. Okay. But with Windows Server 2016, there is a capability where it's easier. It actually, the cluster, how many of you here read the cluster analog for fun? For fun? Really? Really? It's kind of hard to read the cluster error log without understanding what's going on. In fact, I wrote a series of blog posts on how to make the most out of reading the cluster error log. But the point is, in Windows Server 2016, there's a summary of what the errors are in just one shot without having to read every single one of them. Going back, again, to your question, there's no way for you to eliminate that because, again, it's dependent on DNS. But I don't want you to ignore them. In fact, what I did in my previous job was I actually collected all of these and analyzed them using analysis services for reporting purposes and then predicted where the potential error might come from, which, again, the BI guy was a database guy. Life's fun, okay? If you have any questions, send me. Oh, by the way, feedback, green. That's the only color that I know. I'm colorblind. Green. If you have any questions, send me an email. More than happy to answer your questions. I'm going to be outside. I don't know what. It's 5:45, the next one. If you have any questions, feel free to ask me questions afterwards. And again, thanks for coming. I really appreciate your time.